I think it's really important to lift up other women, obviously, and I have done that my whole career. I love playing with women and touring with women. That said, I think it's also really important to make the best musical experience that you can. And when you're a musician, I think it needs to be about the music first. So I don't ever want to hire people because they're a woman. You know what I mean? I want to hire people because they're the best damn player for the job. And I feel so lucky that that's how it's always been for me. So that's kind of my favorite thing about making music, is that music is music, and that's going to be the best music you can possibly make. And sometimes that's going to be with a band of all women, and sometimes it's going to be in a band with two women and two men, and sometimes it's going to be a band that's all guys. Like, that's my take on it, at least, is I think it's crucial to make these connections. And when you find a real musical connection, and when you find a real spiritual musical partner, make music with them.
That was Aoife O'Donovan, and this is Sheeros, a podcast with a mission: to turn up the volume of women's voices in music across genres and generations. Sheeros is a deep dive into the experiences and perspectives of women and gender expansive folks in a still overwhelmingly male-dominated music industry. It's a space where we discuss challenges and triumphs, how far we've come, and how far we still have to go. Telling our stories is the first step to making music better for everyone. I'm Carmel Holt. They say to know your future, you must know your past. And with just 10 days left of Women's History Month in this particularly tumultuous election year and a time when women's rights are at stake, it couldn't be a more perfect moment for the release of Aoife O'Donovan's fourth full-length solo album, All My Friends. The album has a unique origin story, and one could say has been years in the making, as half of the songs had their first life as pieces written for and performed with an orchestra before their rebirth as songs for this new album. In today's conversation, Aoife will tell us how, in the midst of the pandemic, she was commissioned by the Orlando Philharmonic to write a piece about women's suffrage to mark the centennial of the 19th Amendment, the passage of which finally gave women the right to vote in August of 1920. It was a hard-won victory, and as Aoife began her research, she was especially inspired by the woman who helped to bring the amendment to ratification, Carrie Chapman Catt, who served as the president of the National American Women's Suffrage Movement. The resulting work, titled America Come, was a five-piece song cycle, which premiered in 2021 with the Orlando Philharmonic. The following year, Aoife released her third solo album, the three-time Grammy-nominated Age of Apathy, the writing of which had overlapped with the America Come project, and as we will learn, followed a period of creative stagnancy and uncertainty for Aoife O'Donovan, and would fuel not only the completion of the America Come song cycle, but also inform and inspire this new album, All My Friends, which includes reimaginings of those five songs, as well as three new ones and a poignant Dylan cover for good measure. And while the album reminds us and inspires us to learn about and continue the fight for equality, Aoife has endured her own times of self-doubt, grief, and worry as a woman, as a daughter, and as a parent to her own daughter, and infuse these new songs that reflect on our collective and individual past with a message of hope, optimism, and perseverance into a better future. I'm thrilled to welcome back Aoife O'Donovan as this week's Sheero in the Spotlight. Aoife O'Donovan, welcome to Sheero. So great to see you. We did it.
So great to see you, Carmel. Yes, we are so tech savvy. I love this.
When did we see each other in Brooklyn? A couple months ago, yeah?
Yeah, almost exactly 2 months ago. That was so fun. I'm so grateful for you coming down and getting so into the music and having such great questions. You're just the best.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. But, you know, it's easy when talking to somebody like you about a project like this. The new album is called All My Friends. How are you feeling now that you've gotten to sit with the album for a little bit longer and starting to feel the response?
I'm really excited about it. You know, when I last spoke with you in early January, it felt a little bit nebulous. We were coming off the holidays. I think that was like the end of my winter break. I got to New York and it all felt like, wow, am I really jumping straight into 2024 with this new record and this new music? That's all pretty heavy. And from there, I went to Europe and I actually was able to do most of the songs from the record live with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra. And that was really special. That kind of made it feel like, oh, this is a real thing. And a couple nights before that, I did a bunch of the songs for the first time ever solo, live in front of an audience with the Danish String Quartet, I was on this beautiful show with them, and I'm really excited to play this music for people. I'm really excited for people to get the record and to listen to it. And it's not a record full of radio-friendly jams. You know, it's really not. It's a record that you're going to have to sit with and listen to and give it some time. And it's thought-provoking.
Yeah. And it's funny talking about the radio thing. I'm like, I've been spinning a couple of these tracks on Shiro's radio. So listeners, you've probably already heard all my friends on the show. And this is the kind of music that stops you in your tracks. These are the driveway moments in radio that I personally really treasure, as both as a listener and as a curator of playlists. And it's so cool to hear you talking about wanting the album to come to life. I know that performance is so important to you. This project has so many things about it that are unique. And one of them is that you actually have had a long runway with some of this material, that you've already experienced playing with an orchestra. The origins are with an orchestra. So talk to us a little bit about that for those that don't already know the story of the genesis of All My Friends.
It's true. And it really, a long runway is actually a very good way to put it. It's like I'm imagining myself playing as readying for Taxi. This record started really in 2019. The idea was floated to me. I was asked by the Orlando Phil, the orchestra here in Orlando where I live, that my husband is the conductor of. They asked me to write a piece, as many orchestras did around that time, to commemorate the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which of course was the amendment to the Constitution granting women the right to vote. Many orchestras were asking female composers to create new works for them to perform during that season in honor of this historic event. And I was totally honored to be asked by the OPO, although I was kind of like, really, me? Like, why? Okay, sure, fine. And not to sound falsely modest in any way, but it felt daunting. I was like, can I really do this? But of course, when somebody asks you to do something, they're asking you because they believe that you can do it. And I'm so grateful that they did, because it took a lot of beating myself up, but I did manage to get some sort of creative spark going and wrote these five songs by the deadline to perform the piece during COVID, an outdoor socially distanced concert at Festival Park here in Orlando. Wasn't supposed to be like that. It was supposed to be indoors at the concert hall, yada, yada. And it was really powerful. It was such a cool experience. I wrote the music first. I made all these demos. I sent them to an incredible orchestrator, a woman named Tanner Porter, who I was very lucky to work with. And she and I really worked very collaboratively on these arrangements. It's all her orchestration based on sort of reductions that I had done in the studio with lots of keyboards and lots of guitars and lots of vocals. Anyway, that was the first five songs. I have sort of song cycle called America Come. And then I sat on it, put out Age of Apathy, toured a bunch, wrote a bunch more music, released a bunch more music. And it was only last year in 2023, Fresh Grass Festival said, we want to commission you to do something. And I was like, you know what? That's a cool idea. Why don't I finish this record? And was really inspired to write three more songs and then a new arrangement of Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which they were really helpful in bringing to life. And we were able to do it live, which is a big undertaking because it was so many people. And that was at Fresh Grass in September.
Why don't we play a song from that first five song cycle? Feels like an Natural Entry Point is the title track, but I also don't want to like push us there.
I think the title track is a really good place for people to start because it's a very simple song. It's kind of a waltz. Sounds very folky to me, I think, in the harmonic structure and even in the lyric. I love how the song opens with me and the Westerlies. It's a trumpet and trombone. Two of the members of the Westerlies are kind of mimicking these vocal harmonies, and they really sound like some sort of weird, far away, long ago human voice. And it's so beautiful. And when the San Francisco Girls Chorus comes in, that's when you're just like, oh my gosh.
All my friends, all my friends, will meet the end someday. So I'll sing a song for them to guide them. Through the violet haze and the ocean's my load feels heavy most days. Oh, my friends.
All My Friends, title track to the new album by Aoife O'Donovan, her fourth full-length album of original material. She's our guest today on Shiro's, and I'm Carmel Holt. So what was the first song that you wrote for this collection, and like, how did you tackle this, I guess? Like, when they were like, okay, we want you to do this, and you were like, who, me? And then you said, okay, me, yes, I'll do it. What happened next?
Well, next was the deadline. That was kind of the craziest part, is when you are asked to write something and it has to be submitted. I needed to turn it into Tanner. I needed to get these orchestral parts written, notated. Eric needed the score. He needed the charts. The string players needed to be able to mark them up, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this sort of coincided with the early days of the pandemic. And I think many artists will remember that despite having all of this newfound time on our hands, I guess I can only speak for myself because some people probably had the total opposite experience. But for me, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm done. I don't have anything to say. I have no creative ideas. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is it for me. And it was really kind of a dark moment. And I remember finally getting out of it the summer of 2020, the late summer, and eventually moving from New York to Florida. And really, that was kind of when like the cork was popped off. And a lot of ideas started to come. And I remember starting to write All My Friends. I had kind of been playing around with that melody and even that phrase, All My Friends, just way before, like probably in 2017, but it never went anywhere. So I kind of finished that song first. And what came next was actually Daughters, The Seeds of Daughters. And I remember sitting on my porch, as I loved to do in those autumnal days in Florida during COVID, because it really was still like, I mean, it was still the pandemic at that point, even if it had been 6 months. And I remember sitting on my porch and playing that little guitar riff and coming up with that first line, here in the dark, everything that once was becomes a tiny spark. And just looking back, like, I just feel like the story started to unfold a little bit. But there weren't many other words that came in that time period. I finished the music first. Like I said, did all these big arrangements on my own at Full Sail, sent them to Tanner to orchestrate. And I worked on the lyrics over the next several months and didn't actually finish the lyrics until right before the performance.
Wait, okay, this is news to me. I don't know if I knew this detail before. If I did, it left me. I feel like I'm hearing it for the first time. That's crazy. And wait, didn't Age of Apathy
Age of Apathy overlapped. So Age of Apathy, like that fall, like November, December 2020, it was right around then that I started to think about Age of Apathy. It was like January that I got in touch with Joe Henry, or maybe December we had a call. And then January is when I got back and really started to like get shit done and write these songs. And that's kind of what I mean about the cork popping off. It was sort of like, okay, like it's still there. It's still in there. I actually do have a lot to say. But I think because I was so focused on Age of Apathy at that point and all of those songs, and like I was in that mentality, I just kind of set aside these demos for America Come and All My Friends, because I was sort of like, let me finish Age of Apathy. Once we mastered Age of Apathy, it was in April of 2021. And really, it was like when I got back from that trip, I was like, okay, I got to hunker down and finish. I had been like, you know, taking moments here and there to do research and read and study. But that was when I kind of finished the lyrics, was April and May of 2021.
Wow. Okay. So, and then you ended up in your research discovering this story of Carrie Chapman Catt, which was a name that I did not know. We all know Susan B. Anthony, for example. That's one that just kind of like rolls off the tongue. But
she's on the coin.
She's on the coin. How did Carrie Chapman Catt capture your imagination? Why did you decide that it was her that was going to inspire the material?
It's funny. My initial idea was to write five songs from five different perspectives, almost like a one-woman show of these five different characters that I was going to sort of create. But cool. What I realized when I kind of got a little further down that road was it's really hard to tell a story in like 3 minutes or 4 minutes in a folk song. And there just felt like there was a little bit more to go on. And as I kind of got deeper into reading about the movement and the time period and the historical, I don't know, just kind of what was going on, I was so struck by my discovery of actual archival documents and text and letters. And that was sort of where I really kind of honed in on Carrie Chapman Catt. You know, I had heard about her reading this book called The Woman's Hour by Elaine Weiss, where she is kind of a central figure in that book. And she was hugely instrumental for sort of the last chapter, the last page of actually getting the votes to ratify the 19th Amendment. So I feel like that's the time that I was focusing on. But when I read these things that she had written and these speeches that she had gave, and they felt so resonant, and there was just so much truth and so much wisdom, and I felt so connected to her ideas. That was when I was like, all right, I really focus on her for two of the songs, I think, Crisis and America Come. Her text is used, her direct quotes from her speeches are in those songs. All My Friends is very much like my imagining of her. I wouldn't say that that's based in any real historical document that I read. I mean, they did obviously take the train to Tennessee and they did march, and that's sort of like an imagined dreamscape of like her inner world. Whereas Crisis and America Come are more sort of literal. War Measure, the third song on the record, is based on a letter that Woodrow Wilson wrote to Carrie Chapman Catt. She and he were corresponding, and he was very receptive to her wants and her sort of demands, which is interesting because Woodrow Wilson is a complicated character, but he really was very pro-suffrage. And that's kind of like a raucous number, if you can call it that, on my folk album with orchestra. But it's funny, when I finished this first batch, and in the next bunch of songs is where I really kind of said, okay, I'm going to kind of get further into this imagined life of Carrie Chapman Catt. And that's sort of where The Right Time and Someone to Follow come from.
Let's go into one of those songs. I was thinking about The Right Time. Is that a good place to go now?
Yeah, that's funny. That's a song that I feel like I like it more and more as like the time goes by. And when I've done it live, I've been sort of like, this song is really hitting for me right now. It's a song that I wrote trying to think about what it must have been like to be her, to sort of be stuck in this time period where there were very few options for highly intelligent women. I mean, they did exist. You know, women were in certain circles, obviously, able to get out of their town and go to college and become academics. But for many women, even very smart women, the only job that was kind of an option was to one-room schoolhouse, you know, be a teacher. And they were often going to school, and there were often not that many girls in their classes. And this is a song about that, about her leaving Charles City, Iowa, and going to school and trying to, let's give the people in her town, like, I want to be the one that they talk about. When is it going to be my time? When's it going to be the right time?
I feel my power grow.
The Right Time, track 5 on All My Friends, the 4th full-length album of originals by Aoife O'Donovan, our guest today on Shiros. I took note of these lyrics. I feel my power growing, blood pulsing under thick skin. I'm going to move a mountain, baby. That'll give him something to think about. Love that so much.
Oh, gosh. Thank you.
Wow. Your songwriting on this album, you tapped into something new here. Clearly that suits you, that brought your songwriting to a new level of craft that is stunning.
Thank you. It's funny. I think about that sort of the idea of thick skin often, because I feel like that's even a complicated thought, right? That like, we need to have a thicker skin. We need to have a thicker skin that like, you know, yeah. Like you don't want to be accused of being a snowflake or any of these weird internet terms. But I do think that as a woman, as a human being, I have found that it is important not to have a thick skin, but to sort of say, you know what, like that can't hurt me. Nope, you can't get in there because I'm better than that. And I think that's kind of what I mean by that. When I think about like, you know, my daughter, if somebody's teasing her, I'm just saying, you just got to ignore it. Just let it go. And that's, it feels like an underrated quality.
I was thinking about that too. It's hard to ignore parallels or a resonance with one's own experience, or comparing and contrasting, even in a broader sense, like zooming out what life was like for women and what it's like now, but also like on a personal level, what it's like for you, what your experience has been, what your experience is now, what your experience is as a musician and as a woman out in the world in an industry that's very male dominated still. Being a mother and being a musician in this chapter of your career, like all of these various things. So I wanted to explore that with you a little bit more. Like, what kinds of things have been simmering for you as a result of diving into this material and embodying it and thinking about Carrie Chapman Catt?
It's really interesting, even just hearing you sort of describe that, like the zoom out of, yeah, what I feel in referencing the big zoom out of what life is like for me as a musician, as a woman. I personally have been very lucky in my career, in my absolutely male-dominated field, to have come up, I think, in a scene of people and had teachers and mentors who didn't ever make me feel lesser than. I'm not sure if that's just a result of my own sort of innate, some would say, overconfidence that I've definitely had since I was literally a baby. But I think that just the idea of I was kind of brought up to really believe in myself and to speak my mind. And I think that in musical contexts, anybody who's worked with me will say, like, if I feel something or if I think something musically should be different or somebody's not doing something the way I want to do it, I'm very direct. I'm a very direct person. And I think that that has definitely helped in musical context, because I think that when you are direct and when you know what you want and you have the language to say what you want, people just are going to take it a little bit more seriously than if you're sort of, I feel like I'm not sure, like, yeah, I don't, maybe we could do it this way. And I think because that's just not my personality, that's not something I actually think about. I just sort of do it the way I do it. But as I've gotten older, and sometimes I'm in situations, recently I was in a situation where I spoke to a very powerful man in a way that after the fact, I was actually a little bit embarrassed because I think I maybe was a little bit rude. But what happened, the aftermath of which was he said, wow, okay, another alpha in the room. I got it. You're right. And yes, why don't you go and let's figure this out? And it was just such an immediate like, okay, I didn't mean to do that, but I guess it worked out kind of thing. So I think as a mother, I think about that often, like how can I sort of help to instill just confidence and belief that if you feel something strongly, how can we give our daughters the tools, the language in their fields, the confidence and the ability to sort of speak their mind and to command respect. I think that's really important for the women of today.
And again, in the context of this project, so many of these qualities were things that women were grappling with at that time, too. And like, why is it a fight for us still to be seen as equals? And in this moment politically, and I know that this is an area that, you know, you don't really want to make a strong statement around, but it can't go unnoticed that this is coming out in Women's History Month and in an election year. And in a time when women's rights are very much on the line. And so it does trigger these thoughts of both, you know, and I use these words all the time on this show, how far we've come, how far we still have to go.
Of course. You know? No, and I mean, I even think about that in terms of Carrie Chapman Catt writing a letter to Woodrow Wilson and corresponding with the president of the United States. I think that to do that, to have done that in 1918 or whenever that letter was written, you have to have some gall to sort of say, yeah, well, you know what? I am going to write to President Wilson and demand that we are granted suffrage because this is absolute bullshit. You know, it's like, I think that we need more of that. We need more of that sort of taking it by the horns. And just to sort of address the idea that this is coming out in election year, I've always loved to remind people that there are elections all the time. There are local elections, there are state elections. And yes, this is an election year with a big general election that obviously is unbelievably important on a worldwide scale, but there are so many elections that are equally important to your actual day-to-day life as, you know, citizens of whatever town it is that you live in. And that's really where I hope people start to pay closer attention. I know there's a big school board election where I live in Orlando coming up, and it's in August, and just things like that where I think people maybe say like, I was out of town that day. Oh, I didn't realize that when you look at the stats on all of those elections, the smaller elections that people maybe don't pay as much attention to, the voter turnout is quite literally shocking. And not to mention the voter turnout on actual general election day every 4 years. I mean, that's a little bit better, but it's not what it should be.
Has doing this project affected your sense of civic duty?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I've always been very aware of my civic duty. My grandfather, who was a lawyer, who was the son of Greek immigrants who grew up in Revere, Massachusetts, you know, not speaking English. He grew up in a total Greek-speaking community, and he ended up learning English when he got to elementary school, public school, went to BU, went to BU School of Law. He was the kind of guy who really believed in democracy. And I feel like so many of my own beliefs, and it's funny because he was also a very private person. He was somebody who would never tell you how he voted. He believed that it was between you and the ballot box, and he loved to discuss politics. But it was just this really, I think, kind of a very like New England thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I mean, I was born in Boston and raised in Concord, Mass. And so I definitely have that,
you know, that
connection too. Yeah. That appreciation for being in that world.
I mean, I definitely share many of those views that while it is, and I absolutely enjoy discourse, and I think it's really important to have lots of conversations, especially about these really thorny issues that are so divisive, but I firmly believe that it is possible to be friends with somebody who doesn't think the same thing as you. And I think that people like my grandfather, who was a liberal, I mean, he was from Massachusetts. So it's like my perspective is slightly skewed because, like you, I grew up in Boston and didn't really know many Republicans until I was like in my 20s. But that said, I think that civic duty, like jury duty, paying your taxes, supporting your local schools, stopping at a red light, being kind to your neighbors, like all of these things that just feel like people have really lost the thread on common sense. That's, I think, my biggest takeaway of the last sort of era in American politics is on both sides. People just don't have common sense anymore. It's like you think about all these identity politics issues and it's sort of like, well, common sense. Like if you meet somebody and you're friends with them and then they tell you something about themselves that maybe they're gay, or most people aren't going to say, well, now I hate you. Like most people aren't going to do that. Like that's not how humans are. I feel, maybe I'm naive, but I just feel like for the most part, people are good. And I think that if we could listen to each other more and work together more, I really believe that more stuff would get done.
You're here.
I'm such an optimist. I'm sorry.
I
really am. And I think that living in the South also and being maybe more exposed to different viewpoints almost makes me feel that more than when I was living in the Northeast, where it just feels so much like you're in your bubble. And down here, I think that people are willing to talk, willing to chat. And I just feel like we have to participate. We have to pay attention. And Orange County School Board, August 20th.
Go vote. Where should we go next? What song would you like to play from the album?
We could talk about Over the Finish Line with Anais. You want to talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love it. Tell us all about the song. Tell us about your relationship with Anais. Like, how far back do you go?
I met Anais Mitchell in 2005, so 19 years ago, at a festival in Vermont called Roots on the River Festival in Bellows Falls, Vermont. I remember it so clearly because we had this really funny, it was a million years ago. I was like 22 years old, and she was maybe 23. I think she's a year older than me. And we were in this bar playing pool, and I thought she was so cool. And we were just like talking about boys or something silly like that. Fast forward to, you know, 5 years later, she had put out these records. She had put out the original Hadestown folk record around 2010, I think that record came out. Mm-hmm. And kind of we started to run in similar circles, and I would see her more frequently than I had, even though Crooked Still and Anais were definitely in the same kind of worlds in New England in those later part of the aughts. But we became friends and have sort of remained friends and colleagues and sometimes collaborators over the years. We've done shows together. I'm just a huge fan of hers. I mean, she's such an inspiration, I think, to everybody who is in our world, and everybody who's known her for a long time has sort of just watched her kind of create and create and create and really also take steps back and kind of hone her creation. I think the work that she did on Hadestown and how she got it to where it is now from its humble beginnings in sort of like folk theater in Vermont is just really incredible. So I wanted her to sing on this song. I wrote the song and I knew I wanted it to be a duet, and I thought that Anais's voice would just be kind of the perfect choice. She has such a distinct voice. She's not sort of like the first thought of like, what a blendy harmony singer, even though an unbelievable harmony singer. But her voice is just like, immediately it's her. There's nobody else it could be. I wanted that. I wanted her singular Anais-ness.
You heard it.
Yeah, on this record. She also has two small children. I feel like we've had a lot of conversations over the years kind of about a lot of what the song is about, which is me sort of looking back, thinking about what Carrie Chapman Catt was saying, but sort of from the perspective of me, a woman in 2023, when I wrote the song, just like, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to do it? Do we make art? Do we have conversations? Do we try to change people's minds? Do we just acknowledge that we're living in a crazy time? And for how long can we really say that? Is that we feel like we've been saying that since 2016, and it's 2024, you know? dark times, end times, hard times. It's just sort of like become this. That's 8 years.
You've already labeled yourself an optimist. Like, what's your secret?
I think you do just have to continue to make art and make community and really just try to lift yourself up by the beauty that is around you. And I feel that, and I think I've dealt a lot on Age of Apathy with sort of these ideas of like just feeling so apathetic and so dark and so like, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? There's nothing left in any of us at this point. But when I was kind of coming out, the last song on Age of Apathy, Passengers, it's coming out of the apathy and sort of rising above it and being able to remember that like somewhere there's a children's choir practicing, somewhere there's a baby being born, somewhere there's an old couple that are sitting on the couch holding hands. Like, and maybe that sounds totally cheesy and ridiculous in light of all of the awfulness that's happening in the world. I mean, there are wars, global warming is ravaging the planet. People don't have enough to eat. Schools are in disarray. There's just so much that's awful. But I think that it's counterproductive to only dwell on that.
America's bleeding. We're watching her die. Fire and blood on the screen. Her head in the lights receding. She's waving goodbye. The curtain comes down on the scene. Holding a torch high, stumbling below. Luck be a lady tonight. Ships in the shadows, heavy laden with gold. See how they catch the light. If I could change your mind, whose mind? If I could make
Over the Finish Line featuring Anais Mitchell, All My Friends is the new one by Aoife O'Donovan, our guest today on Shiro's, and I'm Carmel Holt. So you told us about how you started this project and how it evolved. What we didn't talk about was how then you made it into a record. Did you take the demos that you had made and use those? Did you completely start over and deconstruct and reconstruct? I mean, because this is like a kind of a big task, because you built these incredible orchestral arrangements for the song cycle America Come. That's 5 songs. So you still had to fill out an album if you were going to do that. So what was that process like?
It was crazy. It was a big process. So I did scrap the demos and I tracked basic tracks of me on guitar with Alan Hampton on bass and Griffin Goldsmith on drums. And we tracked that in May of 2021 after we did the first performance. The guys stayed for a couple days and we went into the studio and tracked those 5 songs. And from there, I had enough to work with to sort of start building around it, start building the orchestral parts. I think we did the first round of strings that summer. I think I then sort of finished vocals maybe a couple of weeks after that and kind of put in some harmonies, et cetera, et cetera. I added a bunch of electric guitar. I added a bunch of piano. We then, the Westerlies rewrote the brass arrangements for themselves. They went in and tracked. San Francisco Girls Choir came in. And at this time, I was also starting to work on the rest of the songs, which were recorded pretty much virtually. So I would do my guitar parts and then send them to bass and drums in a similar way that I did Age of Apathy.
You're not known as somebody who plays piano.
No, and nor would I ever get up on stage and be like, and I'm a pianist. I mean, like, it's like I barely call myself a guitarist, even though I play guitar every day. I don't want anybody to, you know, think I'm being an imposter, but I do play piano. And it was really fun, actually, to get to add so much piano to these songs, especially on America Come. Actually, I put some low piano on that last song, the song called America Come. I think it's track 7. But I also enlisted my friend Rob Berger to play piano on Over the Finish Line, and he did a beautiful job on that. And he plays some accordion on Someone to Follow, too.
We've covered some of this in a previous conversation when we talked around Age of Apathy. But for those that didn't have an opportunity to hear that conversation, can we trace your musical roots a little bit for those Sure. that don't know and don't understand, like, how did this all come to be that now you're writing big orchestral pieces? So was piano your first instrument?
Piano was my first instrument.
Yeah.
Miss Susan Holm was my piano teacher in Newton, Massachusetts. And I had Julia Hawkins in Brookline. And my mom is a pianist. And so I grew up, you know, I think some of my earliest musical moments are me sitting at the piano and like banging out songs with a Rise Up Singing songbook in front of me.
Yes, and, yeah, I love that.
I need
book.
To get it. I'm going to order it today. I played piano. And then in high school, I started playing guitar and getting really kind of into folk music. But I've always been a singer. I mean, like, that's really what I consider myself, as a singer. That's my main gig. Went to college to study music at New England Conservatory and started Crooked Still. And that was kind of my first big band, I guess, that we toured for years and years. And that's where I've met all my friends, is through that sort of folk scene, that bluegrass scene, and still have deep connections with everybody that I've kind of started playing music with back in the early 2000s.
So classical music, was that part of your world at all when you were coming up, or is that pretty new to you now?
It was part of my world in that I was always really exposed to classical music. I mean, my parents are, my dad was a radio DJ, as I think you know, in WGBH, and he had a Celtic music radio show, but we always were a big radio family. So on GBH, there was a ton of classical music, and that was always on. My mom went to BU and studied classical piano. I went to a conservatory, so I was obviously around a ton of classical music, and now I'm married to a classical musician. So I'm married to a conductor and a cellist, and I would say I have a lot more classical music in my life now than I did as a child.
I also wanted to say I'm so sorry about your father, the
Thank
loss
you.
Of your father as he just came up. I love that he's here with us in conversation.
Yeah. Me too. He would have been able to really help me with this tech stuff. He would have been like, you don't have a Zoom handy recorder? What are you fucking on about? He was a great radio DJ and really beloved member of the Boston music community, and really kind of like a celebrity in Boston. So it's a big loss, but his legacy, I mean, I credit him for so much of just like the person that I am. And yeah, he really, really was a great guy.
Was he able to experience America Come?
He was. He got to hear, it's actually a really funny story. Right before he passed. So like it was about maybe 3 weeks before he passed. My sister, actually it's funny, I'm like laughing and crying. But my sister and I were in Boston. He was in hospice already, but he was still able to kind of move around the house. And for anybody who knows my dad who's listening, they know that my dad loved a party. He just loved people. He was so social. He just loved like the idea that you could make anything into a party. And so my sister and I were sitting upstairs with him, and he was lying down, and we were talking about the record. And I was like, do you guys want to go listen to it? Do you want to go have a listening party? So my dad, he heard the word party, and I kid you not, this man is, I mean, he's literally on his deathbed, and I'm only laughing about it because he thought this was so funny after the fact. It was hilarious. He basically jumps out of bed almost. He's in hospice. This is 3 weeks before he passed away. He had terminal brain cancer. Jumps up, grabs a brush, starts brushing his hair, and we're like, and he's like, well, we're going downstairs to the party, right? And my sister and I are like, well, it's just going to be us, but yes, let's go downstairs. So we go downstairs and we listen to it. He loves it. He has a glass of wine. And my sister and I are talking, and I was like, oh, you know, we recorded it here and there, yada, I'm telling my dad all about it. And my sister's like chiming in, but she's using the word we as well. So after my dad gets through the whole thing, he says to my sister, now, what was your involvement in this, Nuala? Really just kind of calling her out that like, she wasn't involved at all. And he knew that. He knew that well. But he was just sort of like, come on, why are you trying to take credit? It was so funny. So he did get to hear it right before he passed. And I'm so glad that he did. He loved it.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That must have been a really moving experience for you to share that. That feels like a little bit of a full circle moment.
It was. And I think that music and just growing up in such a warm and music-filled home, I mean, was the greatest gift that my parents could have ever given me.
Is there a song that when you hear this or when you play this collection that brings that experience to mind or brings your dad to mind?
Yeah, well, I think that the idea, I mean, Someone to Follow, which we haven't talked about, but that's a song that's kind of about, I mean, motherhood and parenthood and the idea that we want our children to be the great leaders of the next generation. And I think that my parents, and their parents. They were raised that way. They raised us that way. And I owe it to all of them to raise my own child that way.
When I look in the glass, I can see you there. Can see you around us. So I follow the stars in the eastern sky, coloring the horizon. Put the moon in your teeth like a piece of cheese, and it's crumbling everywhere. And you're gathering.
Someone to Follow, the new album by Aoife O'Donovan, is called All My Friends, her fourth full-length album of original material. And she's our guest today on Shiro's. I'm Carmel Holt. What's going on with I'm With Her?
Well, I can't really say too much other than that. We've got some stuff cooking.
Okay, good. One of these days, we're going to have the trio of you on the show.
Hell yes, that will be
amazing. I would love that. Speaking of a party, that would be a party.
That would be a real party. Did you talk to Sarah Giroux yet for her new record?
Not yet. It's on the calendar, though.
Great. Yep, I can't wait to hear that episode.
I feel like we may have also talked about this before, but this is one of these things that kind of comes around on a regular basis on this show, talking about collaborating with women, the importance of collaborating with women in music spaces, what that does for us, and if there's even an awareness around the intentional choices to do that, to not do that, all that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like that's an interesting conversation because I think it's really important to lift up other women, obviously, and I have done that my whole career. I love playing with women and touring with women. That said, I think it's also really important to make the best musical experience that you can. And when you're a musician, I think it needs to be about the music first. So I don't ever want to hire people because they're a woman. You know what I mean? I want to hire people because they're the best damn player for the job. And I feel so lucky that that's how it's always been for me. You know, Issa Burke played guitar on my Age of Apathy tour, and she was like, without a doubt, the best person for the job. And we talked about that a lot too, just how rad it is to have a band where there's this complete powerful presence on stage that happens to be a woman. So that's kind of my favorite thing about making music, is that music is music. You have to make music, and that's going to be the best music you can possibly make, sort of in it. And sometimes that's going to be with a band of all women, and sometimes it's going to be in a band with two women and two men, like Crooked Still is two women and three men. And sometimes it's going to be a band that's all guys. Like, you know, you can't say, like, would the Beatles have been a better band if there had been two women in the band? I mean, no, because it wouldn't be the Beatles then. It would be just a different band. That's my take on it, at least, is I think it's crucial to make these connections. And when you find a real musical connection and when you find a real spiritual musical partner, make music with them. And that's how I feel about Yasmin Williams, I think I was mentioning her last time we talked, but she and I put out a song together a couple of months back in the fall. She wrote this gorgeous song and she asked me to sing in it with her. And from the minute I met her 2 years ago, right before Newport, I was like, oh, this is somebody who I want to make music with. You know, just you find your musical soulmate and you run with it.
So well said. And I, perfect Gemini experience. Like, I always have like kind of two minds about it, right? Because it's like, there's part of me that's like, I mean, obviously agree with everything that you just said. And it's not a but an and. Like, I just want to normalize. I want to see the stage normalized. I want to see festival lineups normalized to not even, it's not even a thought to where it's not weird to see a stage full of women. It's not weird, you know, that Alison Russell's band is like top to bottom and her crew top to, you know, all women, all queer folks. When I talked to her last about this album, she said, you know, until it's normal, I'm going to keep making these choices because that's part of her mission. Now, that doesn't have to be everybody's mission.
Right, for sure.
But I was filled with so much respect for that because in a way, you almost have to work harder to make that happen because the list...
Oh, you definitely do. There are just fewer people.
Yeah, and the list that you get put forward, it's like kind of a self-perpetuating cycle. So like even with producers or engineers, there may be plenty of amazing, talented women and queer folks out there that can produce and that can engineer. But I've heard from artists that they get handed these lists that are like, you know, mostly cis white dudes.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, I feel like you get handed lists, and I've definitely been handed lists where there are women on lists for producers. But I feel like the people that I work with, like, are on my team are maybe like slightly more forward thinking than.
Yes. And you're lucky for that.
I am lucky. That's kind of what I mean. Is like, I feel like I've been so lucky in my career to sort of be in these situations where I'm around people who we all kind of have a unified goal. I do firmly believe, though, that when you're making music, I believe that the music has to come first and everything else is second.
Agreed.
So that's where I would personally not say that's not my mission, what Ali's going for, even though I completely respect it just like you. But for me, that is not the case. Music is going to be first and then everything else will be a little bit after that.
That makes sense. Yeah. Another goal, though, I think to talk about or just even to run past you in terms of your feeling about it is being identified by your gender. Like, you're a great female artist. I mean, honestly, like, I could call myself out, you know, like, I'm creating this separate space that's like about women in these spaces. And I, again, here we go, two sides. I love the idea of amplifying women. I love the idea of being aware of and celebrating the things that are different about us and that we bring to the table. I also would love to see a day where we aren't like number of slots to fill on a festival lineup or
for
identified
sure.
as a female guitarist, a female drummer. Oh, what an amazing female bassist they have. Like that. Nobody ever says like, oh my God, what an amazing male drummer that band had. You know?
No, totally. I mean, I think that it's kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier about like everybody just needs common sense again, which is that I think it's amazing to have a thing like Shiro's and Shiro's Radio and to be lifting up women. Because the truth is like we aren't equals right now. Like that's just women make less money than men. Women hold fewer positions of power than men. And it is different, and it's different for moms and dads. It's different. Like, it's just there are differences that kind of can't be ignored. I'm not offended by somebody referring to me as a female musician because it just feels like a fact, like a blonde musician or a 41-year-old musician. Like, I don't, like, it doesn't, like, bother me, so to speak. But again, that sort of maybe goes back to, like, the idea of, like, thick skin, or I just don't really care. It doesn't affect me. Where it starts to annoy me is when somebody says, oh, I can't hire you because I already hired this other person. And I'm like, but we actually sound nothing alike. There's no similarity other than we both have ovaries. Like that's the only thing that's similar about us. That's when you're sort of like, what the? And it's very annoying. But I think that like, you know, my daughter had a homework assignment last week that was, and she's in kindergarten, first of all, why do kindergartners have homework? But it was to draw a picture of her as president and write what you would do if you were president. And I'll send you the picture via text. She drew a picture of her and she wrote underneath it, if I were president, I would stand up for women, !
Yes, girl.
It's totally, it was, yes, exactly. But I loved that because, and I even said to my husband, I'm like, she's always like picks up on it, but I'm not the kind of parent who's like only reading like activist. I'm not doing, that's like not my vibe at all. But I do talk about it sometimes. And I'm like, you know, this record about women voting and women's rights and, you know, did you know women didn't use to have jobs? But I don't beat it over her head. And she wrote it and her teacher did like a big, you know, smiley face check mark. It's like,
oh my God, that's amazing.
Yes. Many feminists.
Many feminists. May there be more. Aoife, this hour is flying by. Before we wrap up, we need to do our Shiro's Magic Wand wish.
Oh, okay, great.
So this is where I hand a magic wand to you, an imaginary magic wand. And I say, with this wand, you have the power to change anything in the music industry for women, non-binary people, queer folks, basically non-males. First wave of the wand, what would you change?
I would say more opportunities at a younger age to be playing in bands, to be playing in orchestras, to be seeing female conductors, if you're an orchestral musician, when you're little, when you're like 5, 6, 7, to go see bands. I remember seeing Alison Russell's band at Fresh Grass with my daughter, and she was like, all girls in the band? All girls in the band? So yes, it's like, that's what I would change. How about let's start it when your kids are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, elementary school age kids, seeing more representation so that they can say, I can do that too, and just make it so that, talk about normalizing it, let's get more female non-binary musicians as they get older and bring them into the fold.
I love that. It feels like a great setup for us to go out with daughters.
Yes, please. Let's do it.
Do you want to tell us anything about the song before we go into it?
Kind of talked about it a little bit earlier about how I wrote this first line of here in the dark and everything that once was becomes a tiny spark. And it really is kind of just looking back. I always think about like, what are we going to see? What are people going to see 100 years from now when they're looking back at this time? And what do we see that we can't? It's all kind of fuzzy. And I just love that sort of the idea that when you're creating music or even using your imagination or you're kind of slipping away into your mind, you can sort of create this tableau of these powerful women and these scenes and these marches and how they're marching for you and you're then marching for them. It just feels powerful.
Women in schools and counting houses and shops and all the farms, they're all around us. They got babies crying at the breast. Sun sinks in the wind. Mothers of bold American daughters, but they are not afraid. They're lying in wait, listening for the bugle call to send them in. Suffrage is the only way to win.
With thanks once again to Aoife O'Donovan. Thank you so much for being here once again on Shiros, and congratulations on this album.
Thank you. Thank you, Carmel.
Massive thanks once again to Aoife O'Donovan for being with us. Her fourth solo album, All My Friends, is out now on Yep Rock Records. Shiros is produced by me, is mixed and mastered by Kelly Drake. Our original theme music is by Lucius. Shiros is also a nationally syndicated radio show. You can visit shirosradio.com to find out more and support our work with Patreon or merch from the Shiros shop. Keep in touch on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Carmel Holt, or find us at Shiros Radio. And please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps us grow and bring you more Shiros. Until next time, remember, music is our superpower. I'm Carmel Holt. Thanks for listening.